chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make heaven in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Well, this evening we have one of the finest guests, I mean ever, and he's out of Bristol, England, and my gosh, he has in-depth reporting that is just totally mind-blowing is what I'll say. And welcome to our program, Tony Gosling.
Hi, George.
Well, I tell you what, You really have this drive time program now, I understand, and tell us a little bit about that and some of your past to the listening audience that hadn't heard you.
I mean, Bristol is, yeah, is yeah, a fascinating tell us that. City. It's very a lot of young people. It's got the highest concentration of musicians in Britain, and it's a pretty lively place. It was also the springboard for the John Cabot voyages back in the early 1500s, which really were a reconnaissance mission for the colonization of North America. Now, you know, the Spanish had South America pretty much, and the Caribbean, and Britain, North America. So you can see that the North America that is today, the great superpower, really was something that came from a mission that set off from Bristol in, you know, just after 1500, and just after Columbus, actually, you know, from Spain going across slightly south of John Cabot. Now, Cabot was financed by Italians, but it was Bristol merchants that were behind this mission, and that reconnaissance effectively then led to the genocide in North America of something like 25 million Native Americans. So, you know, that mission and those days are, I think, it's really important to focus on that and as the main, I think, legacy of our city. Now, it's not obviously a good thing. You know, it's a bad thing that we did. And, I mean, this is awful terminology that's used. You know, we discovered America. Well, hang on a minute. You know, someone had discovered it before you discovered it. And, yes, there were problems with some of the activities of the Native Americans, but nothing compared to the absolute ruthless devastation caused by this group of merchants based in Bristol. And it was all very secretive as well. People were, you know, very a bit like oil companies are today about their prospecting and whereabouts the oil fields are. You know, no one really wanted to know, anyone else to know what they'd found out about what was going on in North America. Any of your listeners sort of around New England area, I would say, whatever you do, do not miss the Mashinantucket Pequot Museum, and there's a Foxwoods Casino there which basically pays for it, and that museum is absolutely fantastic, and you can go and see there the what they were effectively on the other end of the Bristol reconnaissance mission, where British merchant ships went over there to colonize, and that they played all sorts of hideous games with the Indian tribes that they came across in order to con them and to slowly, you know, sort of take over their lands and that kind of thing. So that's a very good place to go and see that. And you won't see a lot of the material on the internet because the Native Americans there who run that museum keep it pretty much in the museum itself. So you have to actually go through the doors and have a look. It's, I suppose, what they're saying is, look, you know, we don't advertise this, but if you take a real interest in Native American culture here, you can really come and see it. Those were the Bristol merchants that, a few years after Cabot's successful voyage, formed something called the Merchant Venturers. The Merchant Venturers is formed under a royal charter in the 1500s and still exists to this very day. In fact, we had elections here just a couple of weeks ago, where the first ever, as far as I know, merchant venturer mayor, at least in this century or the last century, was removed, and we've got someone from the Labour Party now as the mayor of the city, and the Labour Party have now retaken control of the city council as well, which, you know, for me is a good thing, because they're much more interested in kind of equality and that sort of thing. But look, you know, the other thing, of course, with the merchant venturers is, with their royal charter, is that they were running the slave trade out of Bristol. They, like Liverpool, were doing effectively the same triangular trade, where they went down in raiding parties and had raiding stations down in, mostly in West, down the coast of West Africa, Gambia, places like that, where natives in Africa were just simply rounded up at gunpoint and put onto ships, put in manacles, etc., and shipped over to the United States, mostly to the Caribbean. And that is, again, is, you know, horrific. We had at least 2 million, possibly more, of those poor souls from Africa were thrown overboard, killed, or just simply died on the passage in the slave ships. And again, the same pattern emerges of secrecy, because this was all kept from the Bristol public. Although the money was being made by the Bristol merchants, very little news of what was actually going on these triangular trade ships ever got back to Bristol, because, of course, they'd send guns and things like that down, and other trading goods down to Africa, and the rather nasty leg of the route, which was, you know, where you actually had captives on board the ship, kept well away from Bristol, and then they brought things like sugar back to the city. So I think it's a good idea to just sort of nail what is our city all about here. For many years we were one of the big, you know, the second city of Britain in medieval times, certainly, and there's a great natural port here. So that's where I'm doing the current affairs radio programs. I do two each week, and we do interview members of parliament, we have local politicians on, and then, you know, in the second hour we do a 2 hour show on a Friday as people are driving home, and in the second hour we kind of push the boat out, that is, we do much more kind of forward looking investigative journalism, the sort of investigative journalism that's so lacking. And I got my training at the BBC in London after working in aviation and also in environmental campaigning, having done a lot of I suppose more technical stuff and business stuff. I got really interested in investigative journalism, and I was doing work on, for example, reporting on the radio to London on the IRA bombing campaign that was going on in the early 1990s before the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process, and also, like I said, environmental. This is land occupations, and I suppose most of my work has really been to do with basic social justice, that is to say, this fundamental idea that we've got plenty of resources and we've got to make sure that every single person, without any human being excluded, has got the basic essentials, and that is to say food and water and shelter. And in fact, all this stuff is guaranteed, supposedly, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was this grand document which was signed by everybody at the end of the Second World War. And of course, slowly but surely, since then, those rights have been being eroded, and we've got people like Tony Blair, criminal politician who started an illegal war with George Bush in Iraq, which has now led to massive devastation right across the Middle East, from Iraq, Syria, and the creation of ISIS. This guy is still walking the streets, George. So that international law is starting to fall apart, and about the only international law I can see that's operating is when there's a superpower backing it nowadays.
Right. You know, this Bilderberg meeting is coming up, in Dresden, Germany?
The dates, I think it's in it, the 9th to the 12th, 8th to the 12th of June in Dresden. It's a biggie, this one. Definitely a biggie, because if you look at the past meetings and how this particular location and the people who have been invited as guests fit into that, you've got some anomalies developing. Bilderberg is important also to look at the origins of these things. Bilderberg started in 1954, chaired by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, which it's not just me that's saying he was a German spy during the Second World War. There's strong implications by this Dutch intelligence officer who was working with the British Army, Colonel Oreste Pinto, that the people who were working with Bernhard were actually betraying a lot of the secrets to the Nazis before operations were happening, for example, Operation Market Garden. And if you look at the first meeting of the Bilderberg group and where it gets its name from, it comes from this Bilderberg Hotel where the first meeting took place in Oosterbeek in Holland. Now, Oosterbeek just happens to be the place where 10 years previously a massive slaughter of British airborne forces took place. And this was in a place called the Hexenkessel, which was the German for the Witch's Cauldron, where British airborne troops were surrounded at Arnhem. And it's become pretty clear to me that this was a very good operation planned by Montgomery, you know, so successful in El Alamein and in North Africa, and he was a great tactician. He used to read a chapter of the Bible every night before he went to bed, Montgomery. And basically he was betrayed. I mean, he came up with a really good idea, which was to go around the West Wall, around into the Ruhr, and with an audacious plan. But of course that audacious plan only works if you've got the element of surprise, and there are pictures of Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, the guy that first chaired the Bilderberg meetings 10 years after that, former SS officer. He was in one of the areas of Germany which had more SS than any other part of the country. He was a German aristocracy, a German prince, and many people didn't trust him at all, you know, but apparently Montgomery did. And so the first Bilderberg meeting, I think, is a bit of an in-joke, really. It's saying, look, this was great, the way that our spying managed to kill all these British troops, and many Americans, of course, suffered as a result, because there were three airborne divisions involved in Market Garden. You know, the famous film, A Bridge Too Far, with the 101st Airborne landing at Eindhoven, the 82nd Airborne in and around Nijmegen, and the British 1st Airborne at Arnhem and Oosterbeek. So that whole operation, I think, it was an in-joke. They were saying, well, this is the great bit of spying done by Bernhard and done by the Nazis that led to the deaths of many troops right at the end of the Second World War. The point being that they understood and they knew that if that operation had been successful, the war would have ended by Christmas 1944. It would have been such a devastating blow to cross the Rhine, which was where Arnhem is, that it left the Germans with very little options open to them. It cut their supply lines, made them have to move a lot of heavy things like armoured divisions back from the front to defend this rear area. And of course, what it did is it also gave the Germans another 5 months. Is it 5 or 4 months up until the end of the war from Christmas to squirrel away their wealth around the world, which they were very, very busy doing at the time. They'd started at the Red House meeting in Strasbourg in 1944, arranging to get all of the looted billions from Europe away, mostly to Switzerland, a lot of it to Switzerland, because the Swiss had been making a lot of money out of the Second World War and done a lot of deals with the Nazis, and also, of course, to South America and several other places around the world. But it enabled the Nazis, I think, you know, got to be clear here, this is the Nazis we're talking about, not the Germans, really. It's, this basically effectively this power cult that was going on in Germany and probably still is today elsewhere. To get all that wealth and prepare for an economic empire after the Second World War. So that's why the Bilderberg meeting started in Oosterbeek, in Holland, in that specific place at that specific time, I think, is pretty clear. And over the last few years, George, getting back to your original question, they've been spiralling back in towards that area. Last few years we had Watford near London. Usually you see they go around the periphery of Europe and they go to Canada and places like this, but they haven't really been doing that much over the last few years. They've been kind of spiraling in towards Denmark, Germany, Austria. Interestingly enough, last year's Bilderberg was in Tyrol, in Austria, which I was reading recently in Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which is an absolute must read for anybody that's interested in this. Sort of what the end game was of the Second World War. Manning is an absolute brilliant writer, was a brilliant broadcaster, and of course because he was right on the ball, history has virtually buried him. You know, he's not the sort of guy that Winston Churchill and people like that would want to be writing the history. But what he's been saying about you know that specific book is saying about all this is it makes it pretty clear that there was this empire happening after the Second World War. And he also specifically talks about Tyrol in Austria as one of the key rat lines for the Nazis at the end of the Second World War. So this sort of ties in with the Bilderberg meeting there. And now we're in Dresden this year, and we're coming back to Germany. Now, the thing that shocked me most about this one, George, is that you've got the top six politicians in Germany at the meeting. Now, this has never seen anything like this before. This is a major revelation from the left-wing parties in the Bundestag asked questions, and they said, yes, well, these guys are going to that meeting. And it's Merkel and her top five ministers, foreign minister, we've got defence minister, a whole list of them, treasury, deputy chancellor, all the top people in the German government are going. And of course the part of the Bilderberg's cover story is that this is just an informal meeting between business people and a smattering of politicians. No, that is not what it is. This time certainly it's absolutely obvious. This is the most powerful people in Germany and in German policy presiding over a collection of people from North America and Europe. Most of these meetings are from the NATO countries. And it's taking place in Dresden, which is an old Eastern European country. It used to be part of Eastern Europe. And what's fascinated me is that you've got the national left-wing parties haven't made much of a fuss about it, although they've asked these questions in the Bundestag. It's the local parties in Saxony that are getting annoyed about this and saying, well, you know, what do you think you're doing coming here with this attitude of basically, effectively, an international power elite landing, who think they own the planet. And then what they've been doing over the last 60 years or so is simply privatising everything in sight, everything you can see. Everything is being privatised. Genetic material is being privatised. So whereas we've got this wonderful planet we all live on, where there's an abundance of natural resources, the earth, the land, space to live, a free gift to mankind, these people think they own the place and they want to exclude everybody from it. And so that's why privatisation is so important to these people, is because they simply want to be able to buy it all up and own it all so that we can't have it and we have to come cap in hand to them. And I think that's one of the things I would tease out about the whole sort of fascist project, really, of Hitler and since the Second World War, is this greed, right, really, and wish to possess more and more and more all the time. And I don't think there's any real ideological whether it's a threat or an ideological criticism of communism and the left and socialism and this kind of thing. It's actually just that this threatens their personal private empires, and that it might be that maybe a bank, which is a massive, massive reserve of wealth, might just be taken over by a government and might be nationalised and maybe shared out more amongst the general population. This is their real fear, George, I think.
Right, right. What about UK remaining a European Union? What are your thoughts on that? Is that going to happen or what?
Well, it's a $64,000 question.
Huh?
€64,000 question.
Yeah, right.
Look, I honestly can't call this one.
Right.
I'm looking at various of the polls, talking to friends, etc. It seems as if it's pretty well balanced. And whichever way it comes out, I don't think it's going to be a great majority one way or the other. All I can tell you is that there is a massive amount of bamboozling going on of people through something called Project Fear here. Basically, the world is going to collapse around our ears if Britain leaves the European Union. That's what we're being told by what they call the Remain campaign. Now, as far as I'm concerned, much of my work looking into Bilderberg since I first did it back in 1995, when I first came across them, I first published the first lists of the Bilderbergers on the internet that had ever been published, from the Reuters secret little article database I managed to get access to. I put that online, and within 3 or 4 days, my service provider shut the site down because they said there was so much traffic going to it. You know, this is the early days of the internet, really. But that list that I put up there has kind of snowballed into what is a much bigger website now, www.bilderberg.org, if I can plug that. And much of my research into these Bilderbergers.
Sure, sure.
I mean, one of the first quotes I came across was from George McGee. I think he was the U.S. ambassador to West Germany, as it was at the time. He's quoted as saying that the European community and the European Union actually were formed through the Bilderberg conferences. And this is where people were brought together to get everybody on board. And, of course, you're being schmoozed by big media, people like the Murdoch Empire, and their predecessors, the Economist, magazines like this, as well as royalty. And what it does is it tends to get everyone on side. And then what happens is if you're not on side, you seem to find either that your career comes to a sticky end, or you have some kind of embarrassing exploit, a bit like Dominic Strauss-Kahn had at the IMF. You know, something happens and you're kind of spun out of international politics. So I think you're dealing with effectively a kind of cult when you're dealing with Bilderberg, and they want they only want their own people on side. I mean, the strong influence of the Rockefeller family, and of course we all know about Ida Tarbell. Well, most people do about Ida Tarbell and the breakup of Standard Oil through a lot of effort and antitrust laws in the United States, and because they've been monopolising the entire oil industry, and vertical integration, that is buying up oil fields, refineries, gas stations, and basically controlling the entire market, that is, to be able to, price fixing and massive profit making. And this is, I think, where you find the link between the Nazis and the people in the US, not just Prescott Bush and the coup attempt by Prescott Bush before World War II, and that being stopped by Smedley Butler. You've got effectively cartel systems, Rockefeller and his oil cartel, and the German cartels, people like IG Farben, actually with a similar kind of idea. Well, look, all we need to do is control the government, allow massive cartels to develop, and we can own and control and run the entire planet. And that's what they've been doing. But look, I think it's pretty obvious. Everything's been being privatized. Governments have been being denuded. Regulation has been smashed, particularly in banking, with the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland doing international regulation of banking. Well, there's been very little regulation. The banks have been able to do pretty much what they wanted, including false accounting, fraud, money laundering, etc., etc. There is no real regulation of banks, and so these guys are basically in charge. I mean, that's certainly the way I see it, and that's their mission, is to sort of run everything. One of the good things about this Brexit referendum debate we're having in Britain at the moment is that we're hearing much more the term United States of Europe. We're also hearing from the politician, former mayor of London, Bullingdon Club member with David Cameron and George Osborne, that's Boris Johnson, has been actually comparing the European Union to the Nazis and to Hitler, and saying, well, isn't it interesting that what the EU is trying to do is exactly what Hitler was trying to do and Napoleon was trying to do. What he didn't mention, George, was that all of these groupings are also very much opposed to Russia, and Napoleon tried to conquer Moscow and Russia. Hitler, obviously, Barbarossa, that was one of the main objectives of Hitler, was to smash the Soviet Union. And we're seeing the same sort of thing going on today with the European Union and its intervention in Ukraine, supporting of far-right and fascist groups, effectively, in Ukraine, neo-Nazis. In fact, no, Ukrainian neo-Nazis are not neo-Nazis. They are Nazis. They have pictures of Nazis. That's right, and they have.
Yeah, they go back to the old original, don't they?
Of their Nazi heroes. I mean, you can kind of understand it to a certain extent, because Ukraine was, a colony effectively of the Soviet bloc, and many people there see them as the big bad guys who were our colonial masters. But you don't have to have quite such a backlash. that you start putting jackboots and swastikas on and marching around and Zeke Heiling everywhere. You know, that is really over the top. But the EU is supporting this. So this is why I think it's right for Boris Johnson to point out these historical facts, so that people like Angela Merkel cannot get away with supporting neo-Nazis or Nazis anymore. You know, we're in a really dangerous position now, in a kind of almost like a pre-World War II position, both financially and with the racism that's going on now, with the so-called migrant crisis, which has been largely engineered through the Middle East wars and through the mafia shipping people across the Mediterranean. But it's a dangerous place to be, that. And, you know, the EU has really proved itself to be utterly incompetent, or maybe deliberately incompetent, who knows, George. Dealing with these two major crises. One is the financial crisis, which has left literally tens of millions of southern Europeans without any prospect of work, particularly young people, destitute families, evictions all over the place. And so the financial system that the EU has brought in, the Eurozone, has been an absolute disaster, should be booted out immediately. But because people are now through the private banking systems that are actually tied to these cash point networks that we've got right across Europe, and the SWIFT payment system, all this kind of thing, is a private system, it's very difficult for people like the Greek government to do anything about it. They've simply got to go back, cap in hand, to the European Central Bank time and time again, to the IMF time and time again, and beg, basically. So you've got another way that European governments have been denuded, you know, sort of whittled away slowly. So United States of Europe is a really good thing to be hearing, because that's exactly what they've been trying to do, a political union. And of course it is, you know, different methods, but the same result, a unified Europe under one political system that Hitler and Napoleon were trying to do. But you see, the thing is, the United States of Europe would be the biggest kind of conglomeration in the world. You're talking about 500 million people, a little bit more. I mean, the United States, people forget these figures sometimes, but the US has got a population of about 320 million, and Russia about only 150 million, and the Chinese 1.3 billion. So, you know, this is...
And India's in there too at one point, what, 2 billion or something?
They are more non-aligned, and so...
In a way,
on the risk board, they're like a little player on their own. The big superpowers definitely are the United States. I'm talking about the more belligerent ones and the more, militarized up, the likely to get involved in a big conflict, are Europe... as one, you know,
sure.
And the United States tied together through NATO, and then you've got Russia and China, and this is something I was just, as I was driving home tonight, I was just thinking, this was running through my mind, George, and I don't know, I'd be really interested to see what your take on this is, and it's that it looks to me as if we've got a kind of Orwellian situation which has been set up over decades, possibly even centuries, where you've got a European US-NATO axis on the one hand, and China on the other hand. The only thing is, you've got another quantity that's sitting in the middle, the Russians, which they've tried for a long, long time to get the Russians integrated. They nearly did very well in the Yeltsin era and getting it all privatized and bought up. But this guy Putin came along at the right time to kick out the chief oligarchs, people like Berezovsky, who are privatizing, you know, selling off the entire country. And so Russia is a kind of little ingredient that I think it's fair to say that the power brokers in the West had not counted on. And so you've got a kind of counterbalancing influence. Russia at the moment is probably the only thing that's keeping us from some kind of like massive resource war, because Russia is able to deal with the Chinese, and they're also very polite, amazingly enough, to the Europeans and the Americans, and kind of balancing these massive power blocks of Russia and NATO. So anyway, I just wonder what your take of that on all that is, George.
Well, you know, you can't leave out Erdogan there in Turkey. You know what I mean? Siebel Edmonds uncovered corruption between the Pentagon and the Turkish military years ago. And so what I see going on right now is that they're building up in the northeast part of Syria for a ground invasion of Syria. And that's going to come forth here pretty soon, it looks like. But also Erdogan is in there right as a player, like I would not believe. And then the Saudis are in there.
Again, the Saudis are part
and,
of the NATO.
And then they're Yes. And so the NATO has done a tremendous step-out operation. See what I mean? They've gone way out, and they're instead of having a UN army, it's the NATO that is acting like the world army.
Yeah.
You know, for these interests. Yeah. And so it's these players are coming together, and Russia is being surrounded and being you could say provoked into a larger conflict of some kind, which is very dangerous.
Yeah, there's provocation going on, but of course, you know, you've got a similar sort of thing on a lesser scale, certainly on the news agenda. I'm not sure, you know, quite whether that's, you know, the news agenda is. I mean, just I raise my eyebrows every day when I hear what's being reported and what's not being reported. But in the South China Sea, it looks like there's provocations going on down there too, with the, you know, US mainly. Sort of poking Russian, Chinese.
Well, here's the way I see it right now. With weapon systems that we have, the United States, that are being kept ultra secret, I believe that we can take down some of the threat that Russia would pose to us, or we would not be acting this aggressively towards Russia. Okay. And I think the 9/11 illustrates to me that we have four advanced systems that we have that are very ultra secret. See what I mean? And so that's in the background
true.
Of all of this. See,
very good
it looks like to me
under wraps. But then again, you see, there's another aspect to all this.
That's
year,
right.
Which is that I think it's pretty obvious. Yeah. I mean, you look at, for example, this F-35 aircraft that's being suffered. I mean, it's really not up to scratch. So what's going on is, I think there's wonderful PowerPoint presentations and, you know, air shows where these projects, these various military projects, are demonstrated to governments. Defense ministries are very impressed, commit vast amounts of our money to these projects, but a lot of the time they're being conned. I think there was that incident with the USS Donald Crook a couple of years ago in the Black Sea, where this, I think it's a guided missile destroyer, I may be wrong about that, but it's certainly a very high-tech US ship, sailed into the Black Sea in violation of an agreement with the Russians about how many NATO ships were going to be in the Black Sea at any one time. And the Russians sent one of their fighter bomber, you know, high-speed things over with a couple of pods hanging under the wings with electronic warfare stuff on, and they did a kind of almost a kind of battle run, bombing run, fake bombing run against the ship. So, you know, within a few minutes, they suddenly realised, the Donald Crook people, that hang on, we could be under attack here. So they had to get ready for you know, maybe some incoming bombs and possibly to fire back at the Russian fighter. Anyway, they didn't drop any bombs on them or anything. They just pressed a little button somewhere on the Russian aircraft, and it knocked out all of the equipment on the American ship. Everything's kind of blank screens. You know, this is electronic warfare for you. And the Russians are saying, basically, look, your ship, it may have cost a fortune, it may look wonderful and amazing and can do this, but it's not going to survive in a real fight. And I think there's that. I mean, I'm not saying that the Americans are the only people that have been subject to this kind of thing, but I think that a lot of the military technology that we've got now has been much more about lining the pockets of the private military than about giving.
Well, you're right. America's in the throes. Yeah.
Potential to fight. Look, before I finish that, we've also got the situation with the EU. That we've had pretty much all of our heavy industry in Britain sucked out of the country. So,
America right now, Tony, is in the throes of being plundered.
Also,
and stolen blind. You know, I mean, being plundered. The fighter is just one thing, but it's the central banking operations keeping the financial institutions intact or afloat. You know, but there has been a plundering operation going on for the last 2 or 3 decades in this country.
Well, what that does is
and it's breaking our country. You know,
this is the thing,
it's breaking
if you
us.
Don't have the big steelworks, the energy, coal, that sort of thing, all the barest power that you need to produce things like aircraft, tanks, guns, you know, and also there are other forms of warfare, of course, aren't there? You know, whatever it is, psychological warfare, space warfare, cyber warfare, you know, but it doesn't enable the
cyber
to defend itself. So if you could denude a nation's heavy industry, basically you're saying, well, we can come walking in any time we want to.
Right. The one thing that I see the Bilderbergs have a problem with, though, is that the financial problem. They've taken the interest rates to zero, but there has been no stimulation affected of the world economy, much less America right now is in a recession. Our retail sales, everything, our factory orders, they're way off. The government here is lying to everybody, you know, about this unemployment and all that. There's more people unemployed than ever before in the country. But so right now at the Bilderberg, they have a real problem in the sense that they have been losing control of the financial sector.
Okay.
See what I mean? Worldwide, you know. Yeah. And they don't know what to do, see, because they still need a good economy to function, to keep their interest.
It's so in control, so in power through the banking system, through ownership of us, you know, ownership of our workplaces, ownership of our governments, ownership of our industries, etc. They're in such a powerful place. They don't need to be seen to be doing anything successful. And effectively, they're using the economy as a tool, if you want, a kind of a form of low-intensity warfare against the ordinary population to get them in line. You know, the sorts of people who are good at corralling, you know, I'm talking about the kind of boss that everybody hates, that's just a bully. Those sorts of people are doing very well today because they know that a lot of their employees are absolutely desperate to keep their jobs. Now, this kind of suits the Bilderberger mentality when you've got a whole bunch of effectively people who are incompetent, but they are pliable to an elite, you know, they're useful to an elite. And so the fact that you're absolutely right about the, you know, failing economy, but I think it's deliberate, George. I think it's a deliberate attack on the sort of rights that we've been fighting for.
Well, I see your point, but see, in the 2008 period in there, they had to run out and really shore up those financials that were completely in big trouble. See, and had they been in much better financial shape, they wouldn't have had to do that. So it indicated to me that they had problems worldwide, and China has been a big problem to them too.
Because I think that whole big business was deliberate too. They knew that they'd been cooking the books, and they saw this as a great opportunity to put the burden of their cooked books right onto the public purse, to get public taxpayers to bail them out. Effectively, was the biggest heist in history, 2008. I mean, effectively, you've got a whole bunch of crooks who've been lying for years about the viability of their banking businesses, and they say, oh, we'll hold their hands up, and they say, oh, we're really sorry about all this, but unless you take on this debt, you the public, you the politicians, you the people take on this debt that we've built up, we're going to collapse. They're like the suicide bombers in the room. They're basically threatening everybody, saying unless you do what we say, and they've been doing this with governments obviously for many, many years, and kings and queens, etc. They've done it to the whole population now, that we are having to pay for their I wouldn't even give them the benefit of calling them mistakes. I think the whole thing is deliberate criminality that's been bailed out by the public, and that's, to me, is just, it's just because they're greedy, they want to own everything, and they don't want to actually obey the law. So we've got a criminal elite, a power elite, a criminal elite, that are now effectively calling the shots. The politicians are almost nowhere to be seen in this, and if unless they do as they're told, they don't really seem to become successful. And the only other people that can really challenge them is the mainstream media. Now, the mainstream media here in London is incredibly weak. It sort of scratches the surface occasionally. And sometimes, George, in the whole week, you won't see any real criticism of the system at all, until you get, we have a weekly programme called Question Time on the BBC, where maybe a member of the audience makes a point, you know, which is actually to the point, and you get a big round of applause, but the rest of the real debate is kept off of the mainstream media, and is kept to a very, very narrow, very, very narrow area. Most of the main people from the BBC, from the main programme, which is the nightly BBC News, have been bullied out, forced to leave, etc. Michael Crick, brilliant investigative journalist. We're right in the middle of this amazing scandal, George, here, which is the Conservative election fraud. If you go on to Twitter, for example, you'll find there's a hashtag, Tory election fraud, and it could be that many of David Cameron's MPs, certainly enough to lose him the majority in Parliament, are going to be prosecuted on criminal offences by the police here in Britain for overspending and defrauding their election expenses. So I don't know if you come across that story, but the BBC and some of the main political journalists in London have been trying to keep the lid on that one. It's now coming out that I think it's something like 12 police forces in the country are now investigating fraudulent expenses in the election. So, you know, this is potentially is a bit like the hacking scandal with Rupert Murdoch. It's going to run and run, that one, and very, very bad for the Tories, very bad particularly for Cameron. The other thing I'll tell you is I've heard a few rumours from people in the know, George, that Cameron may step down, whatever the result of the Brexit referendum is, in June, literally the day after the referendum, and someone else then take over the leadership of the Conservative Party and be Prime Minister. That I've heard from several sources, so I think it's pretty credible rumour.
Right. Okay, let's get back to Dresden, okay? Dresden was one of the worst attacks. I think it was a single worst attack during World War II. Is that what you have on that, on Dresden?
A horrific, and it's one of the you know, people point to it as a potentially Harris's big war crime. They reckon around about 25,000 people, mostly civilians, died in Dresden in a massive firebombing of one night, you know. And there was some strategic reasons for it, which was that it was a being used for supplies for the German army for both the Eastern Front and the Western Front, and from rail, and it was a kind of railway hub. But, you know, there is, I think it's fair to say, you know, this is wartime, for goodness sake, that it was, you know, it was part of the, I suppose, shock and awe of trying to kill civilians. And possibly was a war crime, you know, but that may well be why the Germans decided to hold it there, you know, because of that sort of, you know, that where we've got, this is where we, you know, so many Germans were actually the victims. Many Germans who weren't Nazis were the victims in the Second World War, and actually they've got a point there.
Well, we started bombing residential areas, I know, in Berlin, towards the end of World War II. So it was to demoralize the German population.
Maybe also it was partly kind of quid pro quo for the Well, I'm thinking particularly more about...
Or the bombing of England, in London,
These also were, you know, about morale, largely, and, you know, destroying people's morale. And that is a large part of warfare. Actually, it's a large part of business, too. If you've got a business with high morale, good morale, and esprit de corps, like Montgomery, the Desert Fox, had in the 8th Army, winning the Battle of El Alamein, before the Americans had come into the war, by the way. That was and church bells rang out all across England in World War II after El Alamein. Well, you've got a really good esprit de corps where you bring the cooks from the mess room in for the briefing as well as everybody else, and you don't start the briefing until the cooks are in the mess room. everyone really does feel part of the same, they're all on the same team. And when you can do that in a business or in an army or in a country, you're going to be successful, whatever's going to happen. But that, the opposite of that, of course, is happening now. We've got a kind of divide policy. We've got a horrible gap, chasm opening up between rich and poor, which really destroys morale in society when you can see, you know, who is going to help these people. Even people who are fairly wealthy are looking around thinking, my God, what kind of society am I living in? You know, so this is, I think, you know, that effectively is part of Bilderberg's mission, is to put the whole of society on the back foot, effectively, and increase divisions so that it's very difficult for people to have, you know, to fulfil their potential, I suppose. And then we're in the situation where it's much, much easier to divide communities, for example, along racial lines. And that's what seems to happen when you get economic depressions like we've got here in Britain. You've got hideous people with absolutely no food at all, you know, queuing up, being evicted from their homes, this kind of thing. Then it's very, very easy to get poor communities and divide them down racial lines or other lines and get them fighting each other. This is the elite, what the elite love more than anything else is watching poor people fighting each other.
Right. The sarin gas rumors here lately, are they beginning to point those towards another Assad attack using sarin gas? Of course, they lied about the first one, but have you heard, that seemed to be, I think the Israelis are putting out information about Assad and the Syrian government having gas. Have you heard this?
This is the Israeli...
That's something just brand new. That's brand new stuff.
Viruses.
Yeah.
You know, biological weapons, which are racist biological weapons.
Right.
You know, I don't think the Israelis are in any position to point the finger at anybody. They haven't signed the non-proliferation treaty. They've got something like 200 nuclear weapons that they are undeclared, and they completely refuse to admit that they've got. You know, it looks like the Israeli Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, was involved in both the September the 11th attacks and the 7/7 London bombing. So who the hell is Netanyahu and the Israelis to point the finger at anybody? Of course, they love pointing the finger because then it makes it look as if maybe they aren't the people who are guilty. I mean, I did a lot of work on Israeli involvement in the 7/7 attacks in London, and certainly there's at least a couple of very strong indications that they were involved. This company, Verint Systems, which had just got a contract which gave them access to the tube tunnels just a few months before the bomb attacks, run by an expert in explosives from the Israeli army, and also the Benjamin Netanyahu on the day, and the Israeli press office getting a warning of some sort at 7 a.m. on the morning of a surprise attack. You know, this is who'd spoken to the press office that morning, whose name was Dan Shaham, S-H-E-H-A-M. He was the Israeli press spokesperson. And my colleague at the Scottish Sunday Herald in Glasgow was told by him at 7 a.m., well, we've had a warning, and we were on a lockdown, a high security alert from 7 a.m. for a surprise attack. Come on, where did you find out about that from? And so you didn't tell the rest of London, you didn't tell anybody else, but you somehow knew that there was about to be a bomb attack in London, a surprise bomb attack. You know, I'm afraid this sort of stuff doesn't wash, and I don't really listen much to the Israeli finger-pointing, certainly from the government. Obviously, there's quite a lot of very good Israeli citizens out there, but the government and the security services there are absolutely some of the most appalling people on the planet. And it's an apartheid... They're running a racist state.
Right, it looks like Gladio is being used all over.
Moving to the Holy Land, actually mostly European Jews, not Semitic Jews, not from that part of the world, and tell everyone how to behave. They've got a damn cheek.
Right. You know, this Gladio thing is being taken all over the place, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Those techniques.
I mean, you've got... whole history there from really from the end of the Second World War of full flat attacks. That is
right.
To say, I mean, effectively, you're going into...
It looks like seven...
Psychopathic psychology.
Right.
Self...
Well, exactly, exactly. Now, that's strong in these groups, isn't it?
You kind of stab your own arm until it bleeds, and you're screaming, running around the room, saying, he stabbed me, he stabbed me.
Right.
Now, that's effectively what you're doing with the false flag attacks, with the nine things like that. I mean, I don't know if you've come across the article.
Right.
It's on a very good website, which is, you know, because we all know how dreadful Wikipedia is. It's massively infiltrated. There's no proper appeal system if you see your facts being mangled by something.
Right.
There is no appeal system that is in any way effective on Wikipedia. But WikiSpooks is a different story. If you go onto WikiSpooks, you'll find all sorts of good stuff, including this article, 9/11 Israel did it, all the proof in the world. Now, I'm not saying that that article is 100% factual, but it does raise some of the most important issues about the September 11th attacks in one article. And in fact, you know, there is, I think you have to go a long way, maybe through the work of people like Christopher Bolin and others, to really identify the nuts and bolts of what really happened on September the 11th. But certainly the Israelis, and particularly dual Israeli US citizens, it seems, are absolutely key involved in perpetrating the attack. Not just in sitting back and watching them happen, but actually actively involved in and profiting from the September the 11th attacks, which was, you know, that's effectively the forefront of most, you know, people who are really looking into this is knowledge. Chris Bolin, I would actually also say, I met him for the first time back in 2000 at the Bilderberg conference in Jeanval in just outside Brussels, which was. Yeah, I mean, we had a fantastic time down there. There was only a handful of us protesting outside, I suppose, protesting. I was reporting on it too, writing about the conference, you know, talking to the staff from the hotel, trying to talk to some of the guests, talking to the local Belgian TV people about it. We got a load of TV cameras down on the Sunday, which was fantastic. A lot of coverage on the TV and in the newspapers. And that was where I first met Chris, you know, so... I've got a lot of time for him, and American Free Press has gone down a very dark route in the last few years since the death of Jim Tucker and his brilliant work on Bilderberg. They really have gone, I think, I don't know what you make of it, George, down a much more, you know, genuinely anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, where they're, you know, I think that they've become a racist, you know, magazine, and I imagine I'll be meeting some of the reporters there in Dresden, but. You know, I will certainly give them a piece of my mind about some of the coverage that they've been giving of the global situation at American Free Press since Jim Tucker died.
Yeah, you know who's agreed recently with Boris Johnson's view of what's going on about, you know, the German connection there?
Oh, yes.
Was Adam Lavor. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah, interesting.
Right. He recently wrote an article in Mail Online, Adam Lavor did, and he backed up what Boris Johnson was saying about the might and the dominance of the German business machine, so to speak. See what I mean?
Steel company in Europe. I don't know what other parts of the world they're in, but they are massive. Now, we've got a big steelworks in South Wales, because that's where there was a load of coal historically, which is one of the biggest steelworks in the country and under threat of closure. At the moment, ThyssenKrupp could buy it up just at a drop of a hat and could keep those jobs, but they won't, because they want to see what's going to happen with the Brexit vote. You see, this is the sort of thing that's going on here. If Britain votes out, then ThyssenKrupp obviously aren't interested in the plant. If it votes to stay in, then they might use this as a sop to say, well, yeah, I mean, if you vote to stay in, we will keep your plant open. This is what happens when you lose control of your country, which is what the British government's done ever since 1973, when we first joined the European Economic Community and started to have to implement all these directives. You know, so that effectively is, you know, the company that ThyssenKrupp, it was two companies originally, Thyssen and Krupps. Thyssen funded the Nazi Party, Paul Manning says in his brilliant book, and I point people back to this again and again, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, he explains in there Thyssen's method for currying favour with the Nazis in their early days, which was promising them party funds, however many, something like 20 Deutschmarks or something, for every ton of steel they sold. So there was a symbiotic relationship between Thiessen and the Nazi Party, and all, with all this money flowing in, including from the United States, the Nazi Party almost couldn't fail in a country which was failing economically. And then Krupp's, their steel empire, they were one of the people who were building the Tiger tanks for the Second World War. So these are the people who are dominant in steel in Europe right now. And in fact, talking to World War II veterans about this, I was talking to a guy, Barry Wynn, the other day, W-Y-N-N-E. I mean, he was his father worked for the Eighth Army under Montgomery, doing supplies for the Eighth Army, which was a hell of a job, George. They were having to get ships across the North Atlantic, down the coast of North America, then through the Caribbean, through down through South America, then round the Horn of Africa, and up and into Egypt that way, you know, round the right the way, in order to and boot him out of North Africa, which was a hell of a task. But his that was his father Barry's father's job in the war. And Barry then went on, he was in the SAS in Burma and places like that after the Second World War, and then he became one of the first executives in independent television here in Britain, where they were making programs like The Avengers, Armchair Theatre. They were doing some really, well, The Avengers is pretty famous all around the world, and they were making those shows back in the 1960s and early 70s. And Barry's just, you know, talking to him about some of this stuff is you know, you can see that there are when I started talking to him about Thiessen and Krupps, you could see actually a shiver go up his spine. These are the guys. Right.
We've got about 2 minutes left. Right. Tony, why don't you give us a conclusion of some of your thoughts? We've got about 2 minutes left. And give us some websites to come into. I have them up on the web already this evening. But go ahead and reiterate a little bit.
Take place without talking about Freemasonry, because certainly there's some very key people who are on the periphery of it and in the middle of it, who has been proven that were Freemasons. Now, you know, that might not necessarily in itself mean much, but certainly Joseph Rechinger, a Polish guy who was the main person that started the first Bilderberg conference, he was a Mason. Also Andrew Palmer, who was the personal assistant to the Duke of Kent. He actually organised the Bilderberg conference at Turnberry in Scotland, one of the last ones to happen here in Britain, and that managed to leak out. So he is the personal assistant to Britain's chief Freemason, the Grand Wizard, Grand Master of the United Grand Lodge. And he's organising the Bilderberg Conference. So don't tell me Freemasonry's got nothing to do with this. I mean, I've got not a lot against most Freemasons, but what happens is, over generations sometimes, and other times it's just because you get someone with criminal intent who becomes a Freemason, you end up with more and more criminality towards the top of the organisation. It's effectively a religious cult, George, a dangerous religious cult. And yes, Hitler did persecute the Masons, but there's quite a lot of evidence that that was only because there were some decent Freemasons that he wanted to get rid of. So this whole idea of Freemasonry swearing oaths to your own little tiny elite criminal group rather than to the rest of us is a key thing right now and probably into the future. And we really need to get to understand this if we want to put the world back on the right track again, because we cannot allow these criminals to be in power. I mean, you know, we're in a situation now with a criminal elite, I said earlier. But if you go to look at Roberto Saviano's book, he was involved in drug dealing in South America and Mexico and the US and Colombia, cocaine basically. And what he says is that big business nowadays, that is to say in the financial sector, all the big companies doing tax avoidance, that kind of thing, they're modelling themselves on the narco cartels. And the narco cartels are a successful model. They're doing exactly the same. They're working with these big banks like HSBC. The rest of us we're obeying the law, yeah? But these are the guys that are thriving. So we're in a very dangerous situation. And I think possibly the only thing between us and some kind of Armageddon situation at the moment is the strength that the Russians are showing in propping up Syria. Syria is a really key place. We must make sure that that doesn't fall, because if it does to the Israelis and to NATO and to the West, that will be a green light for even more regime change.
Thank you for being with us, Tony Gosling. Appreciate it.